You're listening to Last Word Soccer Club Radio. Only here, lastwordonsports.com.
What's up, Internet? My name is Matt Pollard, and you are listening to Last Word Soccer Club Radio, only here, lastwordonsoccer.com, powered by Last Word on Sports Incorporated, the Beautiful Game Network, and Roughneck Scarves. We got a great show for you this Tuesday evening slash Wednesday, depending on when you are listening to us. We'll be recapping all of the action from leg one of the conference semifinals of the MLS Cup playoffs that happened this past Sunday. We'll be previewing the leg twos of those series that'll be occurring this coming Sunday and Thursday of this week. Maybe also talking a little bit USL Cup. But first of all, let me introduce my co-host, my good friend, Daniel Sperry. How are you doing tonight, my friend?
I'm doing very good. It is, it's been a good weekend. Good week, I guess we'll say that so far. I'm quite excited for, we got a lot coming up this week. Like you said, USL Cup. The national team roster was announced today. I got some fun melding of soccer Twitter and voting Twitter, I guess, today going on down in Florida. And then you've got tons of great soccer matchups this weekend or this upcoming weekend. I don't know, man. I could not be happier. Also, it helps that it looks like the Giants are going to make a coup on the Dodgers front office, or I won't say a coup, but a big heist is going to be pulled off by the San Francisco Giants and landing Farhan Zaidi, which I'm quite excited about. It's been a good week, sports week for me, I guess.
All right. I've completely resigned to the fate under current administration as far as the Dodgers are concerned. I would say at least in the now extended and finite Kershaw era in that respect. Dan, one thing I'm very, very excited about is tomorrow morning everybody's gonna wake up, and regardless of what happens in the counting of votes in the various election things that are occurring in this midterm election, I will not have to see another political ad, and I can just talk to my coworkers about sports. So let's get into it, Dan. Listeners, for those of you living under a rock, this past Sunday, Columbus Crew defeated New York Red Bulls by a score of 1-0, a goal from Giassi Zardes in that game. Really big stop in the final minutes by Zach Steffen on Bradley, a header by Bradley Wright Phillips. Portland got a 2-1 win against the now beleaguered and injured Seattle Sounders. Chad Marshall and Christian Roldan exiting those games with injuries. We've gotten some updates on Chad Marshall later for you in the show. Atlanta United gets a 1-0 win over New York City FC. Miguel Almiron did snart in that game. He did score a goal, but that was called off, I think, correctly by VAR. It was Chris Rometty, if I'm remembering his first name correctly, getting his first professional goal on a set piece for Atlanta in that one, and then a 0-0 barn burner between Real Salt Lake and Sporting Kansas City. But Dan, we will start in chronological order. Your general thoughts of Columbus getting a win over the Red Bulls?
To be honest, I didn't really watch the game. I said last time that I was going to go do this. But then I got invited by a bunch of friends to go watch Bohemian Rhapsody in theaters that Sunday morning. So I kind of was like, I'll ditch the Columbus game. I did go back though, and I watched whatever the shortened game is. You can kind of watch it ends up being like a 20, the condensed game. If you can go watch it, you can watch like 10 to 20 minutes worth of the game. Kind of gives you some good ideas of the gameplay and the game flow. And judging by the numbers too, it looks like the Columbus Crew did exactly what I said that they would need to do to win. And they kind of bunkered in, and all of a sudden Bipay Higuain comes in and they get the goal. Look, you saw from a couple of teams in this first legs here, teams that were able to sit back and sit in a very organized block, go out and get favorable results in the first leg. You saw that with Portland. I would believe that they defended a good portion of the game, but their attacks going forward were very scintillating. When they defended in very strong, resolute blocks. I won't start diving into all the other games as well. Sporting Kansas City did it against RSL. But that was exactly what Columbus had to do to get a result against the New York Red Bulls. They forced them to play with the ball, and that's entirely impressive. The Zardes finish was very good, although that play doesn't really happen without Higuain. Beat by Higuain rounding into his top form at the playoff time is exactly what the Triple G, Dr. Triple G, decided to order. It's exactly what they needed. He's been a huge force for them. Defensively, they've always been a strong team. It's been a matter of, are the goals going to come when they need the goals? And they got that goal. They kept New York Red Bulls out of getting a road goal. If I'm Columbus, I'm pushing super hard to get that road goal within that first 30, 40 minutes, or maybe right after, or you can kind of sit back and make the game manageable. Pip a road goal at halftime in the second leg, and all of a sudden you're sitting there. Red Bulls have to score 2-3, maybe. The crew have set themselves up, I think, in a really good shape going into the second leg. As long as they can find a way to score a goal in that second leg, you know, you would think it would favor them. But a job well done to them for being very resolute in their defense and being very organized. They kind of defended in a block 4-4-2 setup. Very good, very strong. The lines were strong. The movement and the ability to kind of make New York play with the ball, but also be difficult for New York to play through. Because, you know, you can sit there and just say, you can give them the ball, but if you're not organized in defense and you're not strong when it comes to your lines and your organization and the defensive block, then it's kind of you're going to end up getting shredded, especially by some of the attacking talent that the New York Red Bulls have. So, you know, it's kind of ended up being a nightmare matchup for New York, and I think Columbus did a fantastic job.
Never mind what you just said, Dan. Did you at some point in there refer to Greg Berhalter as Dr. Triple G?
I did.
If Greg Berhalter ever starts a rapping career, that absolutely needs to be his rapper name. Okay, but no, I agree with you, Dan. This has been the question that we've had. I'll extend it to Chris Armas, but at least under the Jesse Marsh era of the New York Red Bulls, that they're going to press. They're going to do a lot of things really, really well, but a team that historically, both in their current era and over the course of their entire existence, has not been successful in playoffs, in playoff like competition, certainly in cup finals, and then ultimately in the context of the current regime or the current era of the team, a question about what can they do when they're not able to press another team. And Greg Berhalter and the Columbus crew were perfectly built to do to the Red Bulls when you don't want to get pressed the hell out of by the New York Red Bulls, and it worked extremely effectively. I think this was absolutely mission accomplished for the Columbus crew. They stymied the Red Bulls for the most part. Zach Steffen was going to come up big. You knew he was going to have to make one or two really big saves. He made that one really big save, and they got out of there with a 1-0 win. And they're going to go into the second leg for me, and they're going to do very much the same thing. They're going to come in with a low block. They're going to try and counterattack, and they're going to make the New York Red Bulls try and break them down with numbers, with the ball, and I'm not sure whether or not they're going to get that done. You know, I saw little flashes of players that I really liked. I like what Will Trapp was doing in the midfield for Columbus. I still think that this team is a little bit too dependent on the, initially it was the everybody to Diassi Zardes connection. In the last couple of weeks, it's either been getting the connection to Pipa Higuain, and either Pipa Higuain does stuff or he gets it directly to Diassi Zardes. That is, at least in terms of a direction of a flow chart from players to players, a very, very direct route that I think will be easily intercepted in the second leg. But overall, mission accomplished for the Columbus crew. Fairly straightforward result. I've liked what I've seen from the New York Red Bulls since Chris Armas took over as head coach in terms of some of the things they've improved with possession. I'm still not sure that they do it well enough to say this is a team that can beat other teams in possession over the course of 180-minute two-leg series, and then ultimately get results against quality opponents in MLS. I still think if the Red Bulls are going to go all the way to potentially hosting and winning an MLS Cup, that it is going to have to be by pressing other opponents. And as we've seen from a number of teams, including the crew, all season long and in the first leg, there are easy, very, very simple, albeit, you know, slightly dogmatic approaches and systems that you can implement to stymie what the Red Bulls do so well. Let's move on to the wild animal craziness that was the Portland Timbers taking on the Seattle Sounders in this one, Dan. A 2-0 victory, or 2-1, excuse me, victory for the Portland Timbers. Raul Ruiz Diaz with a fantastic goal 10 minutes in. Jeremy Ubobese with an equally fantastic goal. Really nasty pass by Diego Valeri to tie tie it up in the 17th minute, and then Sebastian Blanco unassisted in the 29th. Only one yellow card in this game, Dan. It went to Gustav Svensson, so no second leg suspensions in terms of yellow card accumulation for any players in this game, and you did have two very, very early substitutions in this match. You had Christian Roldan coming out in the 31st minute for Waylon Francis. Liked some of the things that Francis did, but I thought he was a little bit of a chicken with his head cut off. And then the big one, Roman Torres, having to come in the 40th minute for Chad Marshall. News out of Sounders camp, folks, is that Chad Marshall has had a surgery on his meniscus tear. He is very, very unlikely to make the second leg, and there's recovery time that has to be accounted for, to where, you know, I think depending on how well the recovery is, even if they win, you know, he's potentially, you know, I think that there's some reasonable doubt, Dan, as to whether or not he'd be available for a conference final. But first, your general thoughts on the, you know, on the gift that keeps on giving in the Cascadia Cup.
Yeah, I mean, it was a heck of a first leg. The Ruy Diaz finish was wonderful. That is a very difficult finish to get your body around and get that ball in from the angle that he was running in, to be able to get as much power that he did on it and slot it home. A really great finish from Ruy Diaz. You see why he was so expensive, why he was so sought after, and why he was so successful in the Liga MX. A great goal. However, I think a lot of the injury stuff with Roldan and with Chad Marshall, extremely concerning for them going forward. And it started to all of a sudden feel kind of like the CONCACAF Champions League all over again, where guys were just dropping left and right, and it seemed like every 5 minutes you were wondering, oh gosh, if you have to make two injury subs in the first half of a first leg of a playoff match like that, you're not living right when it comes to the luck. And so that's got to be frustrating for them. I thought Portland did a really good job, though, of responding to the goal and taking the onus upon them to still go get that result at home in the first leg. The problem is that Seattle have that away goal. I think Portland's original plans, I think, go out the window immediately with Ruy Diaz scoring that. Ruy Diaz scores that, they have to go and get that. They have to go and get and try and win that game. I thought they did a good job of doing that. They were able to execute it. Both goals were nice. That counterattack was scintillating. Ibo Bisse has been fantastic for them. That he looked great up there in helping kind of move things around, and especially with Sebastian Blanco cutting in and creating off of him. Just well done from Ibo Bisse. Well done from the Portland Timbers attack to be dangerous continually throughout this game. Because you take that 2-1 lead, and it looked like their plan was to try and keep the keep it manageable, make sure Seattle doesn't get a bunch of goals, and then try and pick and choose their times to attack. I thought they did a really good job managing those times to attack and get forward, because what it does is it really allows them to kind of get back and put some pressure on Seattle and make it so Seattle feels like they have fewer and fewer chances to really do it, and kind of make sure that they're trying to hammer home their chances. And I think once, you know, Seattle didn't really get their rhythm back in the attack in terms of being dangerous until a little bit later in the game. We'll see what happens in the home league. It always is interesting with what Seattle does when they come home. I will be intrigued to see how it all plays out. But man, props to Portland for executing a good game plan and a relatively aggressive one, I thought. There's some teams too that are willing to just sit all the way back. I thought they just did a good job of picking and choosing the right times to get forward, when to be aggressive, and how smart and strong to be in the attack, with the moments that they chose to attack. So, well done Portland for getting the road leg or the road result. We'll see, or the home result in the first leg. Good luck to them in the second leg, because I think Seattle's really going to start gunning for them, and kind of just, you know, it's one of those. I remember when the earthquakes Sporting KC were down earlier in this year. They were down to Houston, and Vermees told them, "There's no tactics. There's nothing on that. You have to go score goals. You have to go out there. You need to score goals. You need to come back." They come back late in the game, win it 3-2. I feel like that's kind of got to be the position that Seattle's in. You know, they're beleaguered. They're down on the aggregate series when it comes to the goals. And it's, I feel like that's got to be, they're at a point where they're going to have to go out, and they're in a position where it's not like, you know, here's some tactics, here's some little things we're going to try. It is, you need to go forward, and you need to get forward, and you need to score goals, and you need to be aggressive in the final third. And I think it's going to make for a hell of a game next time out.
I agree with you, Nana. This game was kind of a tale of two halves for me. You know, you had three goals in the first half. In the first half, you did not have the only yellow card of the game, and that came in the 85th minute to Gustav Svensson. But you know, it was just chaos. It was back and forth. Both teams were really going for it. You know, I can't remember if I said this last week, or I've just said it so many times that I can't remember who I said it to. One of the long held beliefs or laws that I have for these two leg series affairs is that the game, you know, in a 7-game series in like the NBA or the NHL playoffs, you know, the saying is the series doesn't really start until the road team wins a game. For me, as I've seen in my experience with the MLS Cup playoffs, is a series doesn't start until the road team gets a goal. And immediately you had that 10 minutes in, Portland was coming back. Okay, Portland was leading. You had it now to where no matter what happened and how it shook out and everything, if this result on some level held, you figured you were going to get a good second leg, because Seattle already had a road goal, but Portland had the lead on aggregate. And then you had the injuries, and then the second half was just kind of dull for me. You had Portland with most of the ball. I think Seattle was just kind of managing things, but I think, you know, I really saw it from the standpoint of, you know, a extremely important piece of the midfield and the engine for the Seattle set, for the midfield engine for Seattle is gone. Arguably their best defender is gone. Why are you not going and trying to put the dagger into the opponent as opposed to just sitting on a 2-1 lead and then playing for what was effectively full time, you know, what ultimately is halftime in the 180 minutes, potentially 210 minutes to be played. And then on the other side, you know, I really thought that the game was so frenetic and wide open that Seattle really could have tried to do something, even if it was just Raul Ruiz Diaz and Nicolò Daro up top. So I understand the argument behind the decisions that both coaches and the players on the field made in choosing to maintain, you know, the strategy they had that ultimately led to a less exciting second half. I just thought that it was absolutely no fun, and I wanted to see more chaos for the extra 45 minutes. I didn't get that. Hopefully we'll get more of that in the second leg on Thursday. Let's move on to the last Eastern Conference game that we have. NYCFC losing to Atlanta United in this one, Dan, by a score of 1-0. Very, very back and forth pace. You know, I thought City had a bunch of opportunities, but not really a lot of extremely dangerous opportunities, including zero shots on goal and just their second loss at Yankee Stadium within the calendar year. Your thoughts on this game? And I mean, is it pretty safe to say at this point with Almiron back that Atlanta's got this in the bag?
Yeah, I think so, man. I was so amazed at how well Atlanta was able to stifle the New York attack. And part of me, it doesn't surprise me. But man, it's funny because they had brought in Remedy to be Nagby's replacement while he was injured in the midfield. But then you get Nagby back. They went out there with a pretty defensive midfield with Remedy. Lorenowitz is in the mix there. And then you also have Nagby. Nagby played a little bit more centrally, you know, and then you have guys like Kressel and Almiron was up there, but, you know, he did his job for the first, you know, 45 minutes, and they bring in Villalba, who was terrible. Almiron was much more dangerous. If Almiron's got a little bit more in his legs, really, and I think once Atlanta gets another goal, if Atlanta scores early in this one, I think it's pretty much done for New York City FC. I just didn't think that I didn't think the execution was there for them. The play seemed to be, I felt like their wingers were too far back at a time. You know, if they're going to try and go forward and get goals, you know, Tajori Strati and the other winger that they had up there was, the name's kind of escaping me, but Tajori Strati was virtually absent. Then you're just playing David Villa against, Michael Parkhurst and Gonzalez Perez, with Maxi Morales trying to pull strings, and just didn't quite work. I think that's gotta be, I just thought New York's, execution Passing wise, wasn't there defensively. I thought they did a good job, of doing their best to limit the chances, but possession was so heavily in New York City FC's favor that in that, especially in that second half, and their inability to do much with it, was just kind of shocking considering, you know, what the level Maxime Morales and a few of those. I just couldn't get it to work and get it to combine. It's funny because it almost reminded me of Philadelphia playing against New York City FC the way that matchup. But all of a sudden, New York City FC then looked like Philadelphia, and Atlanta looked like New York City FC. You know, they were thorough in their attack in the first half for Atlanta. They poured on the pressure, did their best to get the goal. You could argue, I mean, they did put one in the back of the net. If it hadn't been for Almiron not being onside on that short corner, it would have been a 2-0 road result. I still think this one, you know, if New York City FC did not get that home result, I think the chances of them going to, especially getting out of their, you know, down a road goal and not scoring at home, you know, going on the road to Atlanta, I think it without a lead, with Atlanta having a road goal, I think it doesn't bode well for New York City FC. And I think it's going to be a heavy task for them to get the job done on Sunday.
No, I agree with you, Dan. You know, I thought NYCFC was in a position where they could have done something. I thought that Atlanta was extremely pragmatic and extremely effective. I just thought that New York City FC, knowing that they probably needed a goal in this game, was just going to come out all guns blazing, and they just really weren't. You saw a lot of movement, but not a lot of actual production out of Maxi Morales in the midfield. I agree with you with the comment on the wingers, and there's only so much that, you know, David Villa, I think he's almost 36 now, if not older than that, you know, can do in that situation. And the fact is, Atlanta's a really good team. Atlanta's probably a better team, just slightly, than NYCFC without Miguel Almiron. You add Almiron in there, who I thought was effective in a lot of ways, and then, you know, I think it's pretty obvious, you know, which way this game was going to go. I guess the one saving grace that, you know, NYCFC has in this game is in their first game at Mercedes-Benz Stadium this year. They got a 2-2 draw to that one, so they clearly show that they can score. But I think, you know, they haven't been the same team since Dominique Torrent took over, and I just don't have a whole lot of faith in this team. I just don't have a whole lot of faith in them to go there and get a result, given what they did offensively and what they didn't do offensively. Let's move to the nightcap of the Sunday results, Dan. 1-1 draw between Real Salt Lake and Sporting Kansas City. Albert Rusnak scores in the 51st minute, and then Diego Rubio off the bench off of a pretty terrible mistake by RSL in the 60th minute. I was not able to watch this game live due to Rec League Soccer, so why don't you walk me and the listeners through what happened and what you think of it.
Yeah, I mean, the first half was pretty much, it's weird because you would say Sporting Kansas City actually saw the better of the scoring chances. Real Salt Lake outpossessed them 70-30 in the first half, which is unheard of for a team playing against Sporting Kansas City. And it's it didn't have a whole lot to do with the press, didn't have a whole lot to do with their ability to keep the ball and pin them in. It had a whole lot to do with Sporting Kansas City just not being in sync and getting the ball. It was one of the weirdest games I think I've seen from Sporting all year long. It just seemed like necked an outlet pass from the midfield to the attack. And it wasn't just like, oh, they were pressured and, oh, the press got to them and, you know, they played it right into the opponent's feet. Like, they literally just couldn't, like, they'd have a guy wide open and somehow the ball would find itself 5 feet wide of the targeted player and out of bounds. It was a mess, really, honestly. But the thing was that Real Salt Lake just weren't any dangerous at all with their possession. They weren't any dangerous until the final 15 or the first 15 minutes of the second half, when they did get that goal and a brilliant work from Albert Rusnak. Excuse me. I think he did a good job of kind of making up for his mistake in the first half. He was very upset with the yellow card that he got by Jerry Marufo, you know, saying that the challenge itself did not warrant a yellow card, which I would agree with. I didn't think the challenge was dangerous. in any way, shape, or form, or any worse than what Suni Stephens escaped without a yellow card from. However, it was the timing of it and the cynical nature behind the foul. Duram Zusi had cleared the ball out before Albert Rusnak even attempted to go down to make the tackle. It was late. That is why I got the yellow card. And the yellow card, from my perspective, was pretty well deserved for how late that was. And honestly, if not him, then Suni Stephens should have gotten a yellow card anyways for what he did to Felipe Gutierrez there earlier in the first half. Surprised he didn't get one there, and he would have missed the match, missed the next match as well. Rusnak's goal was wonderful. I mean, he was sitting there in the pocket waiting for the ball. He's kind of screaming and clapping his hands, trying to get the ball, gets it, plays a little 1-2 with Krylak, who heads the ball back to Rusnak, who hits a one-time volley, absolutely thumps it into the back net. So, wonderful strike there. And then Sporting Kansas City had actually done a really good job of forcing Real Salt Lake outside of that did not have much joy trying to break the lines and break into the spaces in the Sporting Kansas City defense. They did a good job of cutting most of everything out. They just couldn't keep the ball and keep it going forward for some odd reason. And that's kind of what led to the second goal. Is I believe Real Salt Lake had the ball, and the Sporting's pressure and their defense on that side just kind of forced that ball all the way back to Raimondo, and Kyrie Shelton kind of forced an odd pass and a badly timed pass back to Raimondo from I believe is Brooks Lennon, and Brooks Lennon plays that ball back to Raimondo. Felipe Gutierrez charges him and does his best to close him down. The clearance there from Raimondo came, deflects off of Felipe Gutierrez. Rubio takes the ball, gets the ball back there, cuts inside. Rubio's off his line, and he faked a shot that froze Raimondo for just 1 second there, because he thought he was going to have to take that shot, kind of make a jump and make it safe. And then Rubio took another touch to his right and then whipped it into that lower corner, hit that second touch. One, probably gave him a more accurate shot. And two, that touch just forced Raimondo to freeze, and it bought him that much time to be able to rip that shot off and kind of force Raimondo to stop his migration back to the middle of the goal. And so by the time Rubio takes the strike into the lower corner, well, it was well hit and well placed. I'm not sure if Raimondo would have been able to get to it if he was in position. It just made it that much easier, because there's no Raimondo had no chance of getting to that shot from the position that he was in, and when he was able to time his dive because of his balance being off. So, and that's not a oh, Diego Rubio just took an extra touch and he got lucky. Like that is something that Diego Rubio knows, in being smart in and around the box, and his finishing ability within the 18 yard, kind of within that danger zone 14 area, really is where he picks up a ton of his goals. And it's his movement and his awareness and his thought process in that area. So perfectly done by Super Sub. I believe he scored in the same minute that he was subbed on. Talk about an instant impact from Diego Rubio. But and then Real Salt Lake really couldn't do much for the rest of the game in getting attacked. They had a couple dangerous chances. One really good save from Tim Melia. I thought Sporting Kansas City did a good job of managing the result. I know what they would agree that it was not a good performance of them, and they did not do exactly what they wanted to. But it is a favorable result for them. They have the road leg, the road goal. They kept the game, the scoreline manageable. Got a draw out of there, and they're setting themselves up for success at home in the second leg against the Real Salt Lake team that is pretty terrible on the road. It'll be interesting to see how this plays out in the second leg. But Sporting Kansas City, I thought, got the result that they needed in that game. They never really put themselves in any danger for the second leg. If they keep a clean sheet on Sunday, I think they'll be able to advance. And especially Real Salt Lake are going to be hurting without Albert Rusnak. That kind of throws a wrench into their plans of what they were doing with Demir Krylak, forces maybe some guys that, and a look that maybe, doesn't benefit the Real Salt Lake much going into that second leg.
I agree with you, Dan. I don't know what it is about playing games at Children's Mercy Park, but Albert Rusnak apparently wants nothing to do with him. That's a joke, of course, folks, when he was negotiating his contract in the middle of RSL going to a game at Sporting Kansas City, and obviously he'll miss the second leg at Sporting due to the yellow card accumulation. But let's get to our previews of the leg two affairs. Dan, we will go in chronological order, folks. Due to a strange car show incident, the Seattle Sounders actually had to move their game up, so they'll be playing on Thursday. Don't be expecting Cascadia playoff game on Sunday. They'll be playing on Thursday at the Clink. So Dan, I'll throw it to you. Seattle, you know, probably down Chad Marshall, certainly down a goal, but they do have a road goal in their pocket. You know, Christian Roldan's, availability is still kind of up in the air. What do you see from the Seattle Sounders perspective? What do the Portland Timbers need to do in order to, hold serve?
Yeah, so, I mean, I think the Sounders, like, the idea that there's not, you know, they just have to go for it. They have to run roughshod over the Timbers, and I think they kind of need to play the game and to pressure it, kind of how FC Dallas did, because FC Dallas was extremely dominant in possession and possession within the final third, but they have nowhere near the creativity and the attacking talent that the Sounders have within the final third. I think this game honestly behooves throwing Will Bruin in up top, and along with Raul Ruiz Diaz, with Ladera pulling strings, and Victor Rodriguez, and maybe Harry Ship. I mean, they have to go all out in this matchup, and you know, maybe some of the personnel with the injuries might lend themselves to being extremely attacking. Here's the thing: it's not like you can't just sit there and say, "Oh, we want to manage the result." I mean, there's a reasonable way to manage the result and still go for it all. They try to just win this game 1-0. I'm sorry, but that's not going to get the job done. They need to get out there and they need to score 2-3 goals in this one if they want to advance. And they're going to have to be, they need to get forward and get going. And if you're Portland, you've got to be strong and resolute in defense. You have to be very organized in your blocks defensively, and then you have to make sure that the chances that you get, you bury. That was one thing that Houston Dynamo did so well against the Timbers last year, if you remember. The Dynamo were the five seed playing against the number one seed. Dynamo 5 seed, Timbers 1 seed. They got, I believe it was a pretty manageable result. In the first game, I ended up like a 0-0 draw or something like that. And then the second leg, or 1-1, something. I think that first leg was probably one of the worst games of soccer I had watched in the postseason ever. And then I remember the second leg, it was, I think the Dynamo had two shots and both of them were goals. And Portland had shoved everybody forward and they were trying to get the goals and trying to win. And Houston took advantage of the chances that they have. And if you're Portland, they have to do exactly that in this road league, because Seattle is going to come for them full throttle. I have no doubts about that. And the thing is that Portland, if they're organized in defense and do a good job of making sure they're blocked correctly, within the midfield, and defensive lines and blocking gaps and all that stuff that goes into, the defensive work and the defensive tactics, all that can be undone if they miss two or three clear-cut chances. That means Imobese, if he gets a chance, has to finish. Valeri's going to have to take care of his chances. Andy Polo is going to have to finish for once in his life with the Timbers, and you're going to be asking Sebastian Blanco to make sure he takes care of the one or two chances that he might get. They have to be absolutely clinical in front of goal to take care of it. But I really do think, one goal from Portland, especially if they can put Seattle on their heels early with a goal, I think that could really kind of set the tie in their favor. But if Seattle scores first, kind of gets that momentum, especially if Seattle scores early, I don't think that bodes well for Portland, because if you see them score early, I'm expecting the Sounders to get at least one goal in here. I think that it can be manageable for the Timbers if they can keep Seattle to one goal. But if they get a goal early, I'm expecting more from Seattle. The Portland Timbers have to be careful of letting the tie get too far out of hand. So if I'm then, you be as resolute as you can defensively, but when you have your chance, you take your freaking chance and you better make it, put the ball in the back of the net. Otherwise, I think Seattle walks away from it. I don't know if I'm ready to, we'll see if I can even make a prediction on this one by the time we get to our actual predictions spot of the podcast. But man, I have a hard time with this one, because I think despite Portland being up, I think this is the one tie that really is just a toss up at this point.
I agree, Dan. I would not be shocked if Giovanni Severe, say, came into this game and busted out the Christmas tree formation again, the 4-3-2-1, you know, that was such a big part of their success this season and that long stretch during the middle of the year when they had, I think, 17 games unbeaten in all competition. Don't quote me on that. So, you know, I think that one is, you know, I think, you know, if you're Portland, you want to slow the game down as much as possible. You want to be in a low block. You want to counter them. You want to frustrate Seattle. And I think if you're the Seattle Sounders, you want to score as early as possible, because then you know that you've got the advantage on road goals, and then you just create an open game. So I think for Portland, you want to hold the gate, you know, against the invading Marauders as much as you possibly can, and then hope for a road goal, but really try to defend the lead that you have, make it slow, essentially do what the Columbus Crew are probably going to want to do against the New York Red Bulls. And the other side for Seattle, I think you come out all guns blazing. You hope that you get a goal early. You hope that Cascadian sanity ensues, and then you hope that you're just able to outgun the Portland Timbers. I think that's the best hope for the Seattle Sounders, but I agree with you, Dan. This is probably the closest and the hardest to call of these four two-leg series. Let's move on to the Sunday games, and the early one is going to be the game that you're at, Dan. Sporting Kansas City, your thoughts on, can they hold home turf, or is this going to be a pretty straightforward, Sporting is going to come ball out against shorthanded RSL and get a result and get their first win at home in the playoffs since that 2013 MLS Cup that featured these two teams?
Yeah, the atmosphere, I will say this, it was interesting. The atmosphere for the game against Real Salt Lake, when they played about a month ago at the beginning of October, was it beginning of October? I don't remember, man, because it was the, I'm trying to think when exactly it was. It might have been the beginning of October, or like September 30th or something, like, right? It might have been like, it was a very late, sorry. I'm bantering with myself in my mind. It was a very late, either late September or first week in October for the RSL Sporting Kansas City matchup. I just didn't think – it's interesting. The atmosphere wasn't quite there. It wasn't quite full. More people were as people expected Sporting Kansas City to take care of Real Salt Lake. And honestly, I don't think many people in Kansas City really saw RSL there. But the following week, the atmosphere surrounding that Galaxy game, the challenge from Matt Beisler that, you know, if the fans show up with that type of atmosphere week in, week out, they're going to, and, you know, they'll go places that they've been dreaming about going, because it makes it difficult for teams. I expect their following home game was decision day against LAFC. And that was a crazy, crazy loud, intense crackling atmosphere, and I expect nothing less than that again on Sunday. And it's going to be a tough out for RSL. They're going to see a lot less of the ball, and I because of how difficult it was for them to do much against the Sporting KC attack in the first leg here, with a ton of the ball, I have a hard time, or sorry, let me rephrase that. Because they had a difficult time going against the Sporting Kansas City defense and breaking them down when they had a ton of the ball in the first leg, I don't really see it benefiting. I don't really see it getting better when they have less of the ball in the second leg. Because if you think Sporting Kansas City is going to lose the possession battle or bunker in and play like they did on their home turf, you're absolutely wrong. And I wouldn't even characterize Sporting Kansas City as bunkering in. I just thought they were incredibly sloppy. Maybe either a little bit too wound up or a little too anxious for the leg. They've got their playoff game out of their system. They've played a ton of really strong games down the stretch. You would expect them to kind of really lock in, get things done. I haven't gone to practice yet this week. I'll be out there tomorrow, kind of gauge what the mentality and how they're feeling going into this one. But you know, I have a hard time seeing Sporting Kansas City lose this one. I just do. this is you know, this is something they've been playing all season for. They've been pushing hard at the final stretch to get into the top spot, to get that home game in the second leg. They believe in their ability at home. They believe that their game and their level will be raised at home. Sporting, you know, Real Salt Lake without Albert Rusnak in that first leg, or not in the first leg, in that meeting back at either end of September, like I said, early October. I don't have the exact date in my head right now, but that meeting without Albert Rusnak, I think, is going to be very different than this time out without Albert Rusnak, because the question is what do they do at striker? And if the answer is still Demir Krylak, then who is their answer in the middle of the park? If it's Bofo Saucedo, I don't see RSL getting much of a result. But if they drop Krylak back and get Corey Baird in there, maybe they can pip one on a counter. But they had two good chances against Sporting Kansas City in that one game back in. So from that match in September 30th, if you take a look at it, if you watch it, one, Sporting Kansas City did not start Johnny Russell, did not start Christian Namath, or did not start Kyrie Shelton or Diego Rubio. They instead started Christian Namath, who did absolutely nothing for them in that first half. They had a ton of chances regardless, should have taking care of business against Real Salt Lake. Nick Raimondo stood on his head, and that was probably the most organized Real Salt Lake's defense has been in their entire season. Lightning doesn't strike twice when it comes to defensive organization, honestly. And I don't think it will for, like, I think somehow Sporting Kansas City will be able to break them down a couple of times and bag a few goals. I expect Sporting Kansas City to come out on top of this one. If RSL is able to manage it, man, it's going to be one of the more impressive upsets in recent years, because I just think that, you know, the difference, you know, Portland last year super injured against that Houston team, and that Houston team was very good, and only 4 or 5 points really separated the top from the bottom of the standings. Most teams were kind of close. This year, Sporting Kansas City have been the upper class of the Western Conference the whole year long. Real Salt Lake have never really been able to separate themselves from the middling pack. We all know they barely squeaked into the postseason. I know they've used that as a rallying cry, but at some point you run into someone who's better than you, and I think that day is going to be for them on Sunday.
I agree, Dan. I think this is a pretty straightforward, comprehensive situation for Sporting Kansas City. RSL's down their best player. They're going to be playing on the road. I think we're going to see a much more focused Sporting Kansas City in this game. And I think in terms of, you know, you've already got the road goal, and I don't see RSL's defense and Nick Raimondo with the season that he's had being able to keep a clean sheet against Sporting Kansas City. You know, whether that's going to be Johnny Russell, you know, scoring a banger that he tends to do, whether that's somebody coming off the bench, maybe a Daniel Shalloway. I have no idea. I'm not in a position to make that prediction, but I think Sporting will find a way to get a goal in this game. So I look at RSL. Where the goal is coming from. Corey Baird's a rookie. He's had a good season, but I don't know that he's ready for that stage and that atmosphere of what he's going to be facing in a playoff game. You know, Jefferson Savarino has not been as impressive of late. You know, Joao Plata is not the Joao Plata of old. Basically, just don't have him mark up against somebody super slow, and you don't have anything to worry about him. You know, ironically, I think Mike Petke's best offensive option in this game might be to do what he did against LAFC and put Demir Krylak up top, go full route one, and hope that he can pull two golazos out of his hat. As long as Matt Beisler and Aiko Parra do their job, which, you know, their average, I would say, is much better than what Danilo Silva and Walker Zimmerman did against Krylach, you know, they're going to get a result. You know, they got three goals. You know, RSL got three goals on two shots on goal and one really lucky bounce off of Walker Zimmerman's forehead. I think it's going to take luck of that kin and more if RSL is really going to hope to get a result. If Sporting shows up, plays their game to the level that they're capable of, I think absolutely it's going to be a comprehensive win, both in the scoreline and in the aggregate score in this game. Let's move on to the Battle of Circle Logos in red versus blue. It's not the Democrats and the Republicans, folks. It is Atlanta United hosting New York City FC. You know, Miguel Marone, I thought, looked good in this game, Dan. I don't know if you risk him going 90 minutes in anticipation for, you know, maybe wanting a little bit more treatment during the international break, but certainly Joseph Martinez is going to come out and absolutely, you know, be thirsting for blood. I don't have a whole lot of faith in NYCFC's defense and midfield right now. You know, talk the citizens who are listening to this podcast off the ledge, or are they doomed to their fate of losing to Atlanta?
I think they're resigned to their fate at this point. You know, I mean, don't literally jump off. My goodness, that'd be awful. But there's more to life than soccer. Trust me. I just don't. It's hard to see the New York City FC team of this year, because last year the knock on Atlanta was. The Atlanta United. It's hard to see the Atlanta United of this year having issues in this second leg, because the knock on Atlanta last year was, okay, if they get against a team, they couldn't beat the really good teams. They had struggles with that. They didn't have, you know, they were crazy on the attacking side, but couldn't play defense very well, didn't have a defensive. With what New York City FC is presumably going to try and throw up against them, they're going to need a good defensive presence in that midfield, and they've got it really in Darlington Nagby. They've got it with Lorenowitz and Nicholas Remedy, something like that. I can't remember what his first name is, but Remedy has been very good as well in kind of that box to box shuttling role that Darlington Nagby has played. It worked well to play both of them. I think you'd like to see a little bit of Villalba and, you know, someone else on the wing, and Martinez and Almiron up in front of them, up in front there, and kind of play that 4-2-3-1 type setup with Lorenowitz and Nagby in that midfield 4-3-3, kind of same idea of having an attacking midfielder, a box to box, and a holder, and a guy who's going to kind of play that cover man like Lorenowitz does for the back line. And I think all of those things there for them is kind of it's there for them to kind of I feel like they've kind of fixed their problems that they had last year. So I just have a really hard time seeing Atlanta screwing this one up. You know, it would take a colossal failure on the finishing end of them and a defensive collapse for it to happen. Because Atlanta's good for at least one goal, and the question is, is New York City FC good for two or three, especially if Atlanta gets a goal early? You know, I don't think New York City FC is good for three goals in this. I think they're lucky to be good for two goals in this one. So I think they got their work cut out for them. It's just too difficult at this point. They've got the away goals thing again going against them. You know, good luck to them. But man, I just don't see it happening.
I think it's pretty simple for New York City FC in this one, Dan. I think they're going to have their best performance since Dominique Torrent took over as the head coach of the program. I think we're going to have to see the best performance from David Villa since his return from injury earlier this season. I don't know that either of those things are likely. I don't know that either of those things are remotely probable, and I don't see either of those things happening. I think anything less than this is going to be a pretty simple, maybe not a runaway victory for Atlanta in, you know, like the Vancouver Whitecaps getting a red card and, you know, getting a red card 20 minutes in and then winning 6-0 with, you know, Joseph Martinez getting a hat trick. I think certainly Atlanta will try to conserve their energy once the result is absolutely in the bag. But I think Atlanta's going to come out firing on all cylinders, and anything less than the best version of NYCFC that they're capable of being right now just flat out isn't going to cut it. And even if they do, I still think they're looking at best a coin flip, or, you know, maybe it's going to be squeaky bum time going into, you know, hoping that you can get a result in PKs you know, behind Sean Johnson. Let's go on to the last game of the evening. We'll flip it in the sense that Columbus Crew and New York Red Bulls were the first game to pick up in the first leg, and the second leg they will be the end they will be at the end they'll be the nightcap on Sunday night. Dan, what do the New York Red Bulls need to do on Sunday at RBA in order to get a result? And what do the Columbus Crew need to do in order to advance again to the conference finals?
Yeah, New York's got to create some clear-cut chances. They've got to really get some chances, and they got to create them for Bradley Wright Phillips. My belief is that if you give Bradley Wright Phillips very good chances, he will score goals. I think history has proven that, and I think it doesn't take anyone with half. It doesn't take much of a brain to really put that idea out there, really. So I'm not presenting anything new. That should be the MO for the Red Bulls: is get Bradley Wright Phillips some chances, create some clear-cut chances. Be a little bit aggressive and kind of be willing to maybe let Columbus Crew attack a little bit. Don't try and suffocate them with the press as much and try and win the ball back. And, you know, if you can kind of invite them out a little bit, might be able to kind of break them down a bit. But I think New York's got their work cut out for them just because of how resolute that Columbus Crew defense has been. What happens with Zach Steffen when it comes to playoff time? He's kind of like the Incredible Hulk during the regular season. He's very good, obviously, a goalkeeper of the year, I guess. But at the same time, when it comes to playoffs, he just kind of turns into the green rage monster and just stops everything that's coming his way. This Columbus Crew team is good. I don't think they have a goal in them here, which is why if I'm the New York Red Bulls, I am trying to get as many goals possible there. I think New York's going to need to get two, just to feel comfortable. Even one goal, from the Crew kind of screws them over there. So if I'm New York, you got to get one or two goals, man. At least if you're going to advance to the next round. The question is whether or not Columbus Crew are either going to get a goal or they're going to be able to defend like they did in that first leg. So we'll see what happens. But man, this one is kind of a toss up there. But I do think the Red Bulls are in trouble there if Columbus is going to defend like they did on Sunday.
I think this is really, really similar to what I was saying about the second leg of the Cascadia game, where you've got the road team coming into this game, has a lead on aggregate, is going to come in and try to be extremely defensive. I think that's what the Columbus Crew are absolutely going to try and do. They're going to let the New York Red Bulls have the ball and not let them play their game. And ultimately, it comes down to the New York Red Bulls, who are a more talented team than the Columbus Crew, who are a more organized team in terms of implementing their style, and their style being distinct and also being something that they execute at an extremely high level. And ultimately, in my opinion, having better star players in Kaku and Bradley Wright Phillips. You know, I'll say it's roughly a toss-up at goalkeeper. No disrespect to Pipa Higuain, in the battle of the number 10s in that case. But, you know, I think ultimately it's going to come down to that. And, you know, time and time again, we've seen the New York Red Bulls and the New Jersey, New York Metro Stars fail in these big moments, and we've seen Bradley Wright Phillips with the New York Red Bulls fail in these big moments when normally if it was a regular season game, they would have gotten a convincing victory. So ultimately, I think it's going to come down to that. I think similar to the Cascadia second leg, I think the quicker the New York Red Bulls get a goal in this one, as soon as that happens, it's on, because then you're even on aggregate and Columbus on some level has to come out of their shell in order to create something offensively, if nothing else, to stymie the growing confidence that the New York Red Bulls will have. You know, if Bradley Wright Phillips buries something 5 minutes in on the run of play in typical BWP fashion, I think immediately there's an exhale from the New York Red Bulls, I think, as opposed to being nervous or thinking, oh God, are we going to blow this again? Oh man, are we going to lose the Columbus Crew again? It's all right. We're in it. Let's go get it, so to speak. And Columbus is going to have to match that intensity. So, you know, for the Seattle home game and for the New York Red Bulls home game, you know, if I'm sitting and watching this game, Dan, the quicker the home team gets a goal, I'm getting the popcorn ready because it's on. All right, let's go to rapid fire. We've got a couple off-season related topics that we're going to get to. First of all, Dan, the last mention that we will bring up of politics on this podcast, in Florida, nothing related to the gubernatorial or senatorial race. What can you tell us about David Beckham's initiative on the ballot for trying to get his Soccer Pacific Stadium for Inter Miami?
In the latest results coming from Florida, I believe 85% of the vote, it was currently in favor at 60-40. I called it 60-40 in favor of the measure passing, which means Inter Miami FC will get their stadium. They will get the development plan that has been brought forward to the vote, to the people. Miami FC is getting a stadium. I don't know when it's going to start happening, when they're going to start breaking ground. But the votes happen. They're giving the public okay now. Honestly, I think it's a good thing. Here's the thing. I'm not too up on Florida political things because I don't live there. So it wasn't a measure that I could really look into yet. But I believe the vote was just for them to get the land and be able to take over the land and develop it. That was what the vote was for. And allowed to build their stadium there. I don't believe it was for public funding for the stadium. I believe this ownership group from Miami has been all about privately financing their stadium for the most part. They've seen kind of what the work that Sporting Kansas City has done with their facilities, albeit Children's Mercy Park was done on public funds, not Sporting Kansas City's dime. However, Sporting Kansas City did pay for a good portion of the training facility that they currently have. David Beckham and his crew was wowed and floored, honestly, by it when they went through and did their tour, according to multiple sources, including Don Garber and David Beckham himself. So, multiple people have said this. So it's not just a little rumor that David Beckham was wowed by a random soccer facility in Kansas City. They have ambition to spend money and to kind of make it a hallmark club in MLS. And I think they're going to be successful with it. For me, the stadium is always the biggest thing. I hate watching New York City FC play in Yankee Stadium. I love that MLS has been very picky recently on teams. You have to get the stadium down if you're going to be in the league. Miami is coming. Inter Miami FC is coming. I don't know when it's going to be, but I'm very excited for it. I am excited that they have a stadium, and there's good things for MLS to get that site locked down so Miami can start building their stadium and start the project and start really have a real timeline of getting it.
Excellent stuff, Dana. Moving on, some news out of LA Galaxy camp, almost perfectly timed with their final for this closing out the season media availability that happened today at the StubHub Center. The LA Galaxy announced that they have parted ways with Pete Vianis, the general manager of the LA Galaxy, who's been much maligned for some of the failures of the club the last couple seasons, undoing a lot of the good work or good assets that Bruce Arena had left them when he left to take over the U.S. men's national team. Something that LA Galaxy Twitter is now jokingly referred to as the curse of AJ. Dan, I don't know if you remember that trade, sending him to the Houston Dynamo, when word came out a couple of months after that the Galaxy knew that Robbie Rogers' future was in doubt for the 2016, or maybe no, this would have been the 2017 season, I think. Yes, Robbie Rogers' fate was now for the 2017 season. He promptly retired at the end of the year. And then, of course, AJ De La Garza was the one who was fouled by Roman Alessandrini to win the PK for Houston Dynamo that ultimately helped them get their start their comeback to win the game on Decision Day 3-2 that eliminated the LA Galaxy from playoff contention for the 2018 season. I think this is a good move, Dan. This was absolutely the blood in the water, the change that I think the organization needed. I think now the big question is, every single person who Chris Klein has hired post Bruce Arena, he has fired or has parted ways with the club under precarious circumstances where there's a doubt as to whether or not it was, oh, we mutually agreed to part ways, or oh, I'm stepping down, or oh, I'm secretly getting fired, but we're saving face, you know, Siggy Smith, etc., etc. So, Chris Klein is now fired two head coaches. Presumably Dominic Kinnear will not be returning, albeit he always had the interim tag with the LA Galaxy. He's now fired general manager Pete Vianis, who he promoted from director of the academy program. Pete Vianis was appointed head of the academy program as Los Dos were coming into existence. So, you know, Pete Vianis hasn't really done a whole lot with the Academy to warrant the results, given, you know, the production, the first team production that the LA Galaxy Academy has gotten since then. And obviously, he's now left. But now at this point, it's, you know, Chris Klein is standing on an island. You know, the big question that I had when Bruce Arena left the club was, how much did everybody else around Bruce learn from him? We learned very quickly when they ultimately won ignominiously won the wooden spoon, that they did not win, they did not learn a whole lot from that. And at this point, it was, who are they going to put in place? So now I think the big question is, Chris Klein has an open general manager position, an open head coaching position. Reading between the tea leaves from his press conference and his availability today, and also, you know, in hindsight, looking back at some of the things he said after the Siggy Smith mutually parting ways, I'm using air quotes here, folks, there's an understanding that that could be, that those two positions could be the same person, potentially. He's doing both of the front office is looking at both of those positions simultaneously and could hire a coach before making a decision, or in conjunction with a general manager, or they can be the same person. On the Riot Squadcast, last week, maybe 2 weeks ago, that's the podcast put out by a couple of guys who are members of the LA Riot Squad, the supporters group for the LA Galaxy. One of their callers came in and said that he ran into Bruce Arena in the LA area at a gas station, and they started chatting up about the Galaxy. He's like, yeah, it's such a disappointment. And Bruce straight up said, yeah, they're talking to me. I don't know what's going to happen or if I want it necessarily, but they're talking to me about the GM position, and then gets in his car and drives up. Totally unconfirmed source. People say crazy stuff on supporters podcast all the time. We say crazy stuff, Cam, but I think at this point, Chris Klein has fired every single other person who he has used to scapegoat. You know, the failures of the 2017 season was all on Kurt Arnulfo. The Galaxy in no way were intending to use all of their homegrown players and use such young players that weren't ready for the MLS level. That was all on Kurt Arnulfo and his decisions with everything. All of the failures from the 2018 season were because of injuries and because Siggy Smith just wasn't able to make it work. And then ultimately, Dominic Kinnear wasn't able to make it work, and now some of those roster issues were all the fault of Pete Vianis and everybody else. So Chris Klein's standing on an island. He doesn't have anybody else left to blame, and if he doesn't hit these next two hires, I don't see how he can reasonably go to any of the fans and validate him still having a job with the LA Galaxy, much less Anschute Entertainment Group at this point. Let's move on, Dan. We'll do some very, very quick final rapid-fire items. The General MLS Season Awards, folks, came out earlier this week that Corey Baird is the Rookie of the Year for 2018, and Zach Steffen is the Goalkeeper of the Year also for 2018. Dan, really quickly, thumbs up, thumbs down?
Yeah, I'll go thumbs up on Corey Baird, 100%. Actually, can I say two thumbs up? Corey Baird's a great player, great guy, really, really, honestly, a really, really nice guy. And then on top of that, I would say thumbs down, honestly, when it comes to Zach Steffen. I like Zach Steffen. I think he's a great goalkeeper. However, Stefan Fried led in significantly more of the statistical categories. My question was, it's interesting that overwhelmingly the players voted for Zach Steffen, where the media overwhelmingly voted for Stefan Fried. I think that's really intriguing. I want to know what that is that went into, you know, the players. So for, you know, Stefan Fried, I believe was third or fourth best when it came to the player vote, where in the media, he was number one at 31% of the media vote. That's the intriguing part to me there. I want to know where that difference was and what the players saw that maybe the media did. Were the media relying too much on statistics? Or maybe Stefan Fried is kind of known for a shocker here and there. Zach Steffen isn't. I'm more surprised at how little love Tim Melia got, because most of the defensive issues on Sporting Kansas City weren't his fault. And he's time and time again kept Sporting Kansas City in goals, in games, especially during their tough run with just ridiculous save after ridiculous save. And they've won points thanks to saves from him. He's broken his career mark that he had.
going into the last season, he's broken multiple times. In the last 2 years, he's saved 50% of his penalty kicks. I'll stop here and don't think I'm a Sporting KC homer. I don't think Melia should have necessarily won. However, I was just shocked that despite being second in the player vote, he ended up fourth overall in the voting. So outside, you know, I want to know what the players are thinking when they put those votes in, because it was so far different from what the media vote was, that it's kind of intriguing there. But, you know, I think Stefan Fry deserved to be in the conversation. Zach Steffen had a great year, really kind of was the toss up. My personal point or my personal opinion is that Stefan Fry probably should have won it. But man, interesting the way that goalkeeper vote went down, and it went down than I think most people expected it to go down.
I heard your phone going off in the background a little bit there, Dan. Was Johnny Russell texting you his opinion on why he voted for Zach Steffen by chance?
I wish I, you know, I actually have never had to do Johnny Russell's interviews over phone. So I'll take not having to deal with a heavy Scottish accent over the phone and trying to transcribe what it sounds like on the phone afterwards. But no, that is, that's actually, the Giants announcing that they got Farhan Saidi, from the Dodgers, that is blowing up my phone at the moment. So, Johnny Russell, I'm sure has his opinions. I'm sure most Sporting Kansas City have their opinions on it, but you know, only so much you can do.
Okay. Moving on. I'll do my votes here, Dan. Two thumbs up for Corey Barrett. I think absolutely the hands down, person, you know, I'd say borderline the only rookie that actually deserved to be even in conversation for this award. You know, if he's in the VIB suite in the hotel, then I think Chris Mueller's down at the lobby, trying to get the broom closet because, he can't get a room. I agree with you. I was stumping for Stefan Fry for this award. I thought Luis Robles, with his stats and the year that he's had, certainly would have deserved more consideration as well. You know, I thought those three between Zach Steffen, Stefan Fry, and Luis Robles were absolutely the three best keepers. Tim Melia is my fourth on that one if we're rounding out the dinner table booth there, Dan. But Red Bull's Twitter seemed to be a little bit upset, given the numbers and the stats behind, Robles. Robles has already won it. Maybe this was, the players wanting to go for somebody different, a young keeper who maybe hadn't won it before. I thought, given that all the turmoil that the Seattle Sounders had in the first half of the season, again, how big and consistent Stefan Fry was keeping them in games, I just thought that the stats backed it up and the eye test backed it up in terms of what he did and how he was able to help his team. I can't really say, I can say that from an emotional standpoint on Stefan, not so much the numbers. I can say it from a numbers standpoint on Robles, not so much the putting the team on his back when they absolutely needed him. Last rapid fire topic before pick comes, Dan. The U.S. national team roster was announced earlier today, folks. We won't go through the whole roster because there's just too much to talk about in the show. We will most probably have an episode before the opening game of the two friendlies they're going to have. First, the U.S. national team will be at Wembley. Wayne Rooney will be playing in that for the Three Lions against the United States. And then I can't remember where the U.S. is going after that. But just really quickly, Dan, the roster's up. Give me one player you're super pumped for.
One player I'm super pumped for. I told you, he's a heck of a talent. He was a really good young talent with Columbus Crew. I'm not sure what happened between him and Columbus, but to see him go to Sweden, and he's been kicking ass there, 22 goals in just under 2,000 minutes between the Swedish Allsvenskan, which is their regular season tournament or the regular season, and then the Swedish Cup, which is their version of the US Open or FA Cup. He's been fantastic for them. Great to see him back in the US men's national team set up. Guy's really talented. I'd like to see him being dangerous on the wings and getting at people. I was kind of thinking about it, and I was like, man, you got Tim Weah on one wing, you got Romain Gall on another, you got Tim Weah, or you got Josh Sargent in the middle, then Christian Pulisic playing as a 10. That's a really tasty lineup, I'll say. So that really excites me. Just thinking about that, I'm super excited for that for the U.S. men's national team going forward. hopefully Romain Gall continues it. And to give you some interesting information here, the second game against Italy will be played in at Stadio Crystal Stadium or something like that, which is in Genk in Belgium. For some freaking reason, the Italians have not played a game in Italy since they failed to qualify for the World Cup.
Oh, wow. Okay, Dan. I'm not going with anybody original or anybody you haven't heard of. Here, I'm going with my ginger man, Josh Sargent, in this one, gradually working his way up the up the corporate ladder at Werder Bremen. Coach and everything said that he's now going to be a more significant part of the first team. I think that's fantastic. He's already got his first goal, you know, for the senior team at the international level, the U.S. national team, that is, under his belt. He's in this one. I'm really excited to see what he and Bobby Wood can do together, especially now that Christian Pulisic is back in this camp, and hopefully they'll be feeding them and they'll be scoring on some English defenders with two left feet. Let's move on to Pick'ems, Dan. We will start on Thursday in Washington State. Seattle Sounders hosting Portland Timbers. This will be at 10:30 p.m. Eastern, a late one for those of you on the East Coast, on Fox Sports 1. Dan, who you got and why? Why don't you give me the score line as well as who's going to advance out of this one?
I'm going to say 2-1 in this one. It goes extra time. Portland wins in a penalty kick shootout just because chaos. We'll go with that.
Chaos theory. I love it, Dan. I'm going to go with the Portland Timbers, and I'm going to say that they get it done in regular time. I do think the Seattle Sounders will get the first goal in this one, but it'll take them a little bit longer than they need to. I just don't know without Chad Marshall that the defense is going to be able to stymie Nicolò Dera and all the movement that you've seen from Raul Ruiz Diaz. Seattle Sounders are at home in this one. They tend to play well at home. But I think Portland's counterattack is ultimately going to get a goal for them, and that's all they're going to need. It's not going to be convincing in terms of the performance, but it's going to be a 1-1 draw, and it's going to be enough for the Portland Timbers. They will advance to the Western Conference Finals. Let's fast forward to Sunday, and we'll start at 3 p.m. Eastern at Children's Mercy Park. Sporting Kansas City hosting Real Salt Lake on ESPN. Dan, who you got and why?
I'm going to say Sporting Kansas City in this one. I say Real Salt Lake actually does get a goal in this one, but I think it's too late of a consolation. I think it's going to be 3-1 to Sporting Kansas City.
I'm going to say 2-0 to Sporting Kansas City in this one. Give me a banger from Johnny Russell, and we'll say that Diego Rubio gets a goal in this one from the run of play as well. And then at that point, Sporting Kansas City lock things down in the final 30 minutes and cruise to a 2-0 victory. Let's move on. 5:30 p.m. Eastern, Atlanta United hosting New York City FC on ESPN. Dan, who you got and why?
I'm going to go with Atlanta in this one. Say 2-0 in this one, honestly. Actually, I'll go Atlanta. Atlanta makes it controllable, plays enough defense that New York City FC can't really ever do anything, but they're going to capitalize at home with a little bit more space to work with in that attack. So I'll take Atlanta winning this 2-0. And then the series aggregate 3-0, right?
Okay, yeah, I will go in the second leg alone. I'll go 3-1 Atlanta United in this one. I think they'll get the first two goals. Miguel Marone's going to ball out. Justin Martinez is going to ball out. The rest of the supporting cast is going to show up. I think New York City FC gets a goal in garbage time. I think it'll be a consolation prize for New York City FC. You know, I'll say David Villa earns a PK, you know, against some sloppy defending with the result already decided, and then David Villa will bury it, and that'll probably be, I'll go on a limb here and say that'll be his last goal and his last appearance for New York City FC. Atlanta will win. Let's see, that'll be 4-1 on aggregate with a road goal. Last game of the night, folks, New York Red Bulls hosting Columbus Crew SC, 7:30 p.m. Eastern on FS1 on Sunday. Dan, who you got and why?
I'm going to go with New York Red Bulls. I think, and I'll say they go 1-0 in regular time, which makes it go to extra time, and then they bag a winner in extra time, say 2-1 to New York Red Bulls through extra time.
I was going to predict the same thing, so of course this isn't going to happen, folks. I'll say Bradley Wright Phillips gets his goal in 90 minutes. We go to extra time, and I think it'll be something crazy where maybe something deflects off, or, you know, maybe an own goal or something crazy like that that we totally didn't predict. Nobody's the hero, but there's definitely somebody who's going to be the memeable, not the villain, but maybe the memeable victim for what happens to them. And ultimately, it'll be New York Red Bulls advancing 2-1 on aggregate. That does it for us, folks. Dan, it's time for last words. Do you have any last words, and where can people find you on the Twitter?
No last words right now. Find me at Twitter, on Twitter, at SparrowDataMine4. You know, great soccer coming up this weekend. A lot of great sports stuff going on right now. Go Niners, go Nick Mullins going into next Monday. I actually kind of hope the Niners just stop screwing their draft spot over like they did last year. But you know what? A lot of great sports this weekend. I will be at Sporting Kansas City, Real Salt Lake. If you will be there, hit me up on Twitter. Come find me. I'd love to say hi, say hello, hang out for a little bit beforehand. Yeah, shoot me a message on Twitter or tweet at me and figure something out. But come on out to Sporting Kansas City RSL if you're in the area or an RSL fan wanting to travel. It's going to be a heck of a show this weekend. Get out there. Go to the games. If you are if you're a Seattle, Atlanta, or New York Red Bulls fan, don't be one of those teams, one of those fan bases that everyone's sitting there during the game and thinking, man, they really couldn't fill their stadium for a playoff game. Don't be one of those teams. Get out, support your stadium, just like you got out and voted today. That's going to be it for me.
Excellent stuff, Dan. For me, Dan, Thursday night, even before the MLS Cup playoffs resume, the USL Cup final is happening. Louisville City FC will be hosting for the second consecutive year. This will be on ESPN 2 at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And they're hosting Phoenix Rising, who boasts Didier Drogba. I think this is maybe one of the most under-talked things that you have going on. You have potentially the first ever double in the new era of the USL in terms of a team winning back-to-back USL titles, and you've got them taking on Didier Drogba, an absolute world star. You know, where would we have predicted this 7 years ago when Drogba was still playing in Europe? Certainly not me. This game will not be at Slugger Field, folks, who a lot of USL fans have maligned as one of the worst surfaces in the league. They'll actually be playing at the University of Louisville's venue that hosts on the campus of the university. Boasts about 4,000 total seats. We'll see what they can do as far as the standing room. They've got kind of a grass bermy area that acts as the student section behind the goal that I'm assuming is going to fill up with the Louisville City supporters. But, you know, an absolutely fantastic USL club that's getting ready to start construction on its own 10,000 seat true Division II soccer specific stadium. An absolutely fantastic team over the course of the last several years since coming into existence. And they're taking on Didier Drogba. I want to watch this. You should want to watch this too. It's on ESPN2, and you should check it out. Listeners, follow me on Twitter at LWSMattPollard. Follow Last Word on soccer.com across all social media platforms at Last Word SC. You can subscribe to Last Word Soccer Club Radio. Just search Last Word Radio or anywhere you get your podcasts. Thank you to our sponsors, Roughneck Scarves, the official scarf supplier of MLS, the USL, and US Soccer. Get your custom scarves for your group or your team at roughneckscarves.com. Listeners, we'll see you next week where we're recapping the conference semifinals, previewing the conference finals, and talking a bunch of other things. Maybe even talking about Didier Drogba lifting the USL Cup after scoring an absolute golazo against Louisville City. Listeners, we'll see you next week.